Welcome to Home Ground. I'm Brian Kahn. Yesterday I thumbed through 30 pages of the encyclopedia. They featured 36 men and 4 women. The fact is, for many centuries, history's been told overwhelmingly through male eyes. A terrific new book is a refreshing exception. Published by the Montana Historical Society, it's titled Beyond School Marms and Madams, and tells fascinating stories about Montana women. Laura Ferguson and Annie Hanshu are two of the book's authors. Many thanks to you both for joining us on Home Ground. Laura, where'd you grow up? What'd your folks do?
I grew up in Clancy, Montana, from a single mom. She worked for the state.
Did you go to school in Clancy?
I went to kindergarten through 8th grade in Clancy and then high school in Helena.
And did you have any college?
Yes, you know, I went to the University of Montana for my bachelor's degree in liberal arts, and then I attended Montana State University for a master's degree in Native American Studies.
When you finished your master's, if you compared your knowledge, values, perspective on the world with when you left Clancy, any changes that resulted from your education in values or knowledge that are important to you today?
Huge changes. I had wondered back in third grade why we don't speak the Blackfeet language, because the Blackfeet tribe was the only tribe I was familiar with in Montana in third grade. By the time I finished my master's degree, I had a whole new view of both Montana and the United States.
Annie, same questions. Where'd you grow up? What'd your folks do?
I grew up in East Helena, Montana. My mom was a public school teacher, and my dad was a bureaucrat for the state of Montana. I went to school in East Helena, went to Helena High School. I attended Carroll College. And then after Carroll, I went to the University of Utah and got a master's in American history.
American history is a rich subject. Did you learn anything you didn't know? Or let's put it this way, looking back on your history education, what are the most important things you learned from your point of view?
To answer your first question, I would learn everything that I didn't know. There was a wealth of knowledge about American history that I didn't have before I went to graduate school.
Really?
When I went to graduate school, I focused specifically on gender history and environmental history, and so I got a really good sense of the important role that women have played in the American West, and also the role that the land has played in our understanding of the American West.
Interesting comment about land and how land influenced us. What do you have in mind, for example?
Well, I think as Montanans, we all share a very strong connection to place. And in history, that plays out in a lot of different ways. We depend on the land for jobs. We depend on it for recreation. We depend on it for spiritual renewal. So you can't really talk about human history, especially in a place as beautiful as Montana, without talking about the role that the land has played in our lives.
Before we get started into the details of the origin and nature of the book, I just want to say I've read a fair amount of history, and I found this book and its format absolutely fascinating because it covers so much ground by having short sections on individual women and organizations. It's a book that you can pick up and read any place and get something serious out of it. What's the background of this? Where did this come from?
Well, this project was intended to be a celebration of 100 years of women being able to vote in Montana. So in November of 1914, men in Montana voted for suffrage for women. We obtained the vote before it was given to women nationally. So in 2014, the Historical Society decided to celebrate that, use that as an opportunity to look at women's stories. And the goal was to get at least 100 stories.
At least 100.
At least 100. So one story for every year that women had had the right to vote. And so that's what you're seeing in the book. It was first a blog that was published online throughout 2014. And the best of these stories have now been collected in this book.
And who was the editor of the project? Because there are many writers, at least 15 approximately.
The editor of the book was Martha Cole of the Montana Historical Society. The book was really also her brainchild. She's the one that brought it all together.
So Laura, if you were to summarize the overarching themes of the book, what would you say?
I would say first that Montana is, in fact, very culturally and ethnically diverse, and that women's history is part of that diversity of the state, that women have shaped the state as well as our own communities in a lot of different ways. I think that women's lives and their histories are not all alike, but they share one thing in common, Brian, and that is that women's private lives are affected by public issues. And in turn, women have to make a significant and lasting impact on public policy and in the public sphere.
You say they have to. I'm assuming you're saying they have.
They definitely have.
Now, you said something about ethnically and culturally diverse. I think, you know, we're a land of immigrants, except for the first peoples. Walking around major cities in Montana and towns, one doesn't get the impression we're very culturally diverse. You don't see a lot of Asians. You see some Native American people. You see a few African Americans, some Hispanic. The implication of what you're saying, it seems to me, is that the ethnic diversity may have changed over time. Is that fair?
I think it is fair in one sense to say that ethnic diversity has changed, particularly since the closing of the big mines in Butte. For example, Butte drew in a lot of immigrants from around the world. Also, the Chinese, basically, who lived in Montana as a large population of Montana, working on the railroads and working in mines and in the mining communities, were excluded from becoming citizens, and many of them ended up leaving Montana. However, we have lots of new immigrants in Montana, the Hmong people, Belarus, Russians. And in addition, we also still have 12 different tribes in Montana.
I didn't realize it was 12.
12 on 7 different reservations, and then the Little Shell don't have a reservation. They're headquartered in Great Falls.
I think you said women have to be involved because public policy affects them. One could say they don't have to be involved. They could be passive observers. Clearly, the book shows that's not the case.
Certainly, historically, it's not the case, and I think a woman who was part of the American Association of University Women, AAUW in Montana, summed it up very, very well when she said, "There are things to do which men and money will never provide."
That's a very interesting comment. What did she mean?
What she meant is that women had to act as advocates for women and families and communities, and they had to find ways, both individually and as groups of women, to affect change that would help women and families and their communities.
That sounds like you're saying, Laura, that women were essential to make communities real in a dimensional sense. Would you have an example to give us, Annie, from that?
I think a really good example in Montana are women's home demonstration clubs. These clubs were meant to work on issues from healthcare to home economics. They helped women feed and clothe their families. They fundraised for charities. So this is one of the ways that women got together in groups and worked to build their community. They worked in conjunction with the Cooperative Extension Service in agriculture and home economics. And the idea was that through expertise and scientific action, they would be able to improve American society and improve the lives of people in their communities. And these groups were especially popular in post-World War II Montana. So women would get together and they would learn how to can. They would learn scientific methods of child rearing. They would learn how to cook. They would learn home management.
You said this was done through the Extension Service, that would be the Department of Agriculture?
Yes.
Laura, you look like you want to add something.
I was just thinking about how effective those home demonstration clubs were, including on American Indian reservations. In the 1920s, the Federated Women's Clubs were formed, and Montana was one of the first states to have Federated Women's Clubs that were exclusively Indian clubs. The first was formed on Fort Belknap. There was also one formed in the 1920s on the Crow Reservation. And on Fort Belknap, Julia Schultz, a tribal member, worked with a public health nurse, Henrietta Crockett, to form the Fort Belknap Indian Women's Club that worked with these home demonstration clubs. And one of the issues that they took on as a club was fighting tuberculosis on the reservation. Up through the 1950s, tuberculosis was a very real health threat on Montana's reservations because of the reservation conditions, people living in very tight quarters with one another, lack of infrastructure. So Henrietta Crockett, the public health nurse, and Julia Schultz worked together to establish clinics where they could train mothers in those women's clubs how to identify tuberculosis, what caused and the spread of tuberculosis, and how to prevent the spread of tuberculosis on the reservation.
Now, these were not hired professionals. These are lay people.
Henrietta Crockett is a public health nurse for the state, so she's a professional, and she took on tuberculosis as her main project.
And Schultz?
And Schultz is a founder of the Fort Belknap Indian Women's Club. She's just a member of the Fort Belknap community.
That happens to be one of the chapters that I read about Julia Schultz, and I would just read something. At age 70, she joined the reporting staff of the Phillips County News, where she worked for the next 20 years. She died at age 104. It's an amazing story.
An amazing story, and the fact that she continued throughout her lifetime to work, to be employed, to be engaged in the community and events going on is very, very impressive.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking about a fascinating book published by the Montana Historical Society, Beyond Schoolmarms and Madams, stories about Montana women's contribution to building this state. With the little knowledge I have of Indian history, I remember smallpox wreaked havoc on Native populations. I didn't know about tuberculosis. Is public health an important role overall thematically in this book relating to women's engagement?
It most certainly is, Brian. Most of Montana's public health reforms were made by the public health nurses who had to cover thousands of square miles in their rounds that they would make through large quadrants of Montana.
It's still a problem of rural health care.
Still a big issue.
Right.
One way that they were able to work with communities is by collaborating with the superintendents of the different county schools. So working with these county superintendents, they would go into schools, assess schools for safety, bring changes to the schools, lighting, ventilation, indoor plumbing, separate lavatories for girls and boys. All of these are things that public health nurses and school superintendents worked on together. They also used schools as a venue to reach rural populations, teaching well baby clinics. They held vaccination clinics. They talked about disinfecting food, pasteurizing milk, for example. And schools became the forum for that so that the public health nurses and the county superintendents, most of whom were women, could work together on these issues.
So these institutions, which you just pointed out, tend to be dominated or led by women, were the lead in the public health improvement efforts.
They certainly are. Women on the ground, it's women working in both those fields.
The other thing that I'm gathering from what you said, and I wonder if it's typical, is the partnership element. If I was to generalize, at the risk of offending some listeners, I'd say men tend to be loners and lead out, quote, end quote, and women tend to work better as partners. Is the latter statement supported by the record?
I agree. Women worked collectively with one another and saw where their lives could overlap or where their work could overlap to achieve a common goal.
And I think a good example of women working together and this collective effort being really important is women working for educational opportunities, especially in early Montana. And one of the clearest places we can see that is where women got together and tried to build public libraries for their communities. They definitely got a boost from the Carnegie Grant Program, but women had to actually go out and access those funds. So
let me just jump in and ask. The Carnegie Grant, that's an East Coast organization with Western outreach?
Andrew Carnegie believed that he should use his wealth as a way to uplift lower members of society. And he felt that education was one of the key ways that he could do that. That's why he funded libraries across the country, but including 17 that were built in Montana. So Andrew Carnegie is providing the funds for this, but it's people in the communities that actually have to have access to those funds to secure land for the library to be built, to make sure that there are going to be books in those libraries, to make sure that the libraries are going going to be staffed. And in truth, both men and women worked on these issues, but it was overwhelmingly the work of women that made these buildings happen.
For example, any particular women?
So, for example, to this day, women volunteer to staff the East Glacier Library. So they continue to put their efforts towards keeping these libraries alive. Another more contemporary example of libraries being important and women serving an important role in that is Alma Jacobs of Great Falls. She served as the Great Falls public librarian for almost 20 years, and then she eventually became the Montana State Librarian in 1973. And she believed that a good library was a community center and a place for educational opportunities. She was often quoted as saying, "The public library is the poor man's university." So she believed passionately that libraries could help uplift communities. And the really interesting thing about Alma Jacobs, in addition to her work in libraries, is that she was an African-American woman living in Montana at a time when most of Montana's African-American population had moved on for other economic opportunities elsewhere.
The book raises an interesting point, that African Americans came and went in fairly large numbers. Remind us why they came.
So African Americans were drawn to the state for the same reason that other people were, for economic opportunities, especially with the railroad and in mining communities. There's also some evidence that some came with people who moved from the South in a service capacity, even though slavery had been abolished.
And then the population declined because?
So the peak population of African Americans was early in the 20th century, around 1910. And then World War I and World War II both siphoned off a lot of that population, either because people were conscripted into the army or because they left for economic opportunities that had been created by the war industry in places like Seattle.
Annie, you mentioned people came for economic development purposes. Let's put it this way. They came into rough country and they developed an economy. Some people left over time, other people stayed. What does the book have to tell us about women's role in those that stayed and what they accomplished?
Well, some women were here already. Indigenous women on the reservations had to work very hard to try to bridge the gap between the lack of economic resources on the reservation and the need for some type of economic development. For example, Lucille Otter is a Salish woman from the Flathead Reservation. She worked for the Indian CCC, the Indian Civilian Conservation Corps, during the Great Depression.
Mm-hmm.
And she was one of the few women who worked in an administrative capacity on the reservation in the Indian CCC. What she saw was that men on the reservation were able to obtain skills that would give them ability to get jobs later on. They were trained as mechanics, heavy equipment operators, electricians, road builders.
Mm-hmm.
And she said the CCC was a godsend for the reservation because unemployment rates were at 90% in the 1930s.
You said 90.
90%. Very, very few job opportunities. After the Great Depression and when the CCC ceases to exist in the early 1940s, Lucille Otter decides to work to achieve something similar in a lasting capacity on the reservation. And one way she does that is by working in the 1950s with Lee Metcalf, a senator from Montana.
I noticed his name several times comes in.
Yes, and he worked very closely with Montana's Indian communities, and they worked together to create the Kicking Horse Job Corps Training Center, modeled after the Indian CCC. Ironically, the first wave of students that went to the Kicking Horse Job Training Center were Navajo. And so it took time to integrate members of the Salish and Kootenai tribes on the Flathead Reservation into the job training center, but it has had huge and lasting impacts in terms of training people for high-wage, blue-collar jobs.
My impression is, from multiple conversations but not verified by scientific evaluation, that the Salish Kootenai tribes still do well economically relative to some other tribes in Montana. Is that true? And does this job background, this organized approach, have anything to do with that?
I believe it is true, and I think that the job background, the job training programs, mm-hmm. for example, play one significant role in that. Another thing I would add to that is that they have really tried to take control of their natural resources. Interestingly enough, Louise Otter was also a prominent figure in that because she helped them set aside the tribal wilderness, the first tribal wilderness in the country, and that was one of her passions. She was a conservationist and an environmentalist and worked very, very hard to think of ways that the tribe could control and conserve their natural resources.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking about a terrific book, Beyond School Marms and Madams, with two of its multiple authors, Annie Hanshew and Laura Ferguson. When one thinks about economic development in Montana, one thinks about mining, and one thinks about Butte, and a complex of things. One, tremendous production of copper during World War I, and eventually, or around the same time, the development of what I'll call heavy politics, controlled by Anaconda Copper, unionization, etc. What's the role of women in all that?
So I think that that's a really interesting story, and it's often overlooked when we talk about Butte. I love this quote from historian Janet Finn. She says, quote, "Women's paid and unpaid labors have made a significant, if undervalued, contribution to the social fabric and economic stability of Butte." And what she means by that is that women's work, especially during periods of conflict, especially when contracts were about to be renewed, especially when miners were on strike, women's contributions to the household economy became especially significant, and they wove the fabric that kept the community together while the men were out striking.
I read one of the chapters about Butte, and it was titled The Women's Protective Union, which I'd never heard of. That chapter's written by Mary Murphy, and it describes the formation of basically a women's union to, quote, improve the conditions of women's work, to extend a network of support and friendship to Butte's working women. And it was supported by the men's union, and it continued to be functional until the 1970s. It was something I was completely ignorant about. Laura?
Economic development and economic justice were also really important issues on the reservations and amongst Montana's Native American population. One of the people who worked on this issue very extensively from the 1950s through the 1980s was Freda Beasley, an Assiniboine who's enrolled at Fort Peck. And Beasley worked through the Montana Intertribal Policy Board, an advisory board to the state government, and through the National Congress of American Indians, formed in 1944 as an advisory board to the federal government, in order to help charter needed changes in federal Indian policy. Until the Johnson administration.
Lyndon Johnson, we're talking
Lyndon
in the 1960s.
Johnson, in the early 1960s, tribal economies and tribal social systems were by and large run by the federal government through the Bureau of Indian Affairs. With the Johnson legislation, for example, the establishment of the Office of Economic Opportunity, tribes have for the first time the opportunity to run social and economic programs for themselves.
I might editorialize a shift from an overtly paternalistic system. Is that what we're talking about?
That's exactly what we're talking about. And Freda Beasley and the National Congress of American Indians are absolutely instrumental in making that happen. She worked very closely, again, with Lee Metcalf to draft some of that legislation to help develop programs such as VISTA, Head Start, Upward Bound, the Bilingual Education Program, Community Access Programs, and Job Corps.
Public policy change of substance almost always involves serious politics, people who oppose those changes, people who fight for them. Is that part of this story?
It's definitely part of this story. And I think the interesting thing is that when you start to include women in the story of politics, you have to go beyond just what the legislature is doing. One great example of that is the work of Gretchen Garber Billings. She worked for a newspaper called The People's Voice. Billings was born in Whitefish. She grew up in Seattle. She came back to Montana after World War II, and she came back to be a journalist for this newspaper, The People's Voice. The People's Voice was based in Helena. It was created in 1948. It was created in part to be an alternative to the Anaconda Company-controlled dailies that were dominating Montana's news industry. And some of the paper's founding fathers are people that we've already mentioned a little bit before, prominent Montana politicians like James Murray and Lee Metcalf. It was a progressive newspaper, is what we would call it today. Back then, you might have called it a farmer labor brand of progressivism.
Very popular in the Northwest, our part of the country.
Definitely, and particularly in Montana. With her husband, who also wrote for the newspaper, Gretchen Billings built this paper into a mouthpiece for progressive causes. So they supported unions, they worked for workers' compensation, they fought for public ownership of utilities, public health reform, Native American rights. And one of the cool things was that they did not steer clear of controversy. In fact, Gretchen Billings said, quote, "We were intentionally contentious because unless there's controversy, people aren't thinking."
They came out against the war in Vietnam.
They came out against the war in Vietnam, and that was an unpopular stance with the paper's board. So eventually they resigned because of that. But what's interesting to note is that a lot of the progressivism that they fought for is then embedded in the 1972 Constitution. So they definitely had an impact in the political narrative of the state.
Laura.
Gretchen Billings is a good example of how women had to work outside of the political system in order to affect political change inside the system. Another example would be Lucille Otter, the Salish woman from the Flathead Reservation. In 1960, Lucille's mother died, and she realized that she had never voted, but her mother had been one of the first American Indian women in Montana to vote in 1924 with the passage of the American Indian Citizenship Act. In 1924, American Indians got ostensibly the right to vote with the passage of the American Indian Citizenship Act, but up through the 1960s, states like Montana put a lot of obstacles in their path to prevent them from voting. So Lucille Otter addressed this by actively working to register voters on the Flathead Reservation. She would tell them, politics, one way or another, controls your destiny. Choose yours today. And she set up registration tables at commodity centers. She would catch people out fishing or hunting, and she carried the registration cards with her. And in about 15 years, she registered over 1,000 American Indian voters on the Flathead Reservation. Tribal leaders today credit their involvement in politics to Lucille Otter having gotten them first voting and then interested in becoming politically active. She said a statement that I think is still true today. "For heaven's sake, pay attention to what is going on in this country. If you don't get involved, we're going down the river."
Laura Ferguson and Annie Hanshew, I very much regret to say we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for being on Home Ground and so much for your work on this exceptional book. And to our listeners, many thanks for being with us. We hope you'll join us next week. Home Ground is an independent production of Artemis Common Ground and does not necessarily reflect the views of this radio station. Post-production by Valtron Recording Studio. We welcome your ideas for new programs at www.homegroundradio.org. Home Ground is made possible by grants from the Liz Claiborne Art Ortenberg Foundation, Cinnabar Foundation, Humanities Montana, and the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication about issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans.